The other thing that people don't understand is just the complexities of actually running and operating and planning a bus network.
How are you? I'm Gary Fox. This is the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast. Today, my guest is Brian from CitySwift. They're taking millions of terabytes of data every single day from buses all across the world and making our transport infrastructure smarter. Here's my chat with Brian. If you've been listening for a while, you know Iconic Offices have been my partner for ages now. Working and recording out of their flexible workspaces has meant a huge deal to the success of this podcast. So it made perfect sense to partner up with them again for season 17, but to give you, my fellow entrepreneurs, a unique offer. Come work in the Iconic Office workspaces for free with no catches. Simply visit the link in the description below and enter Gary24 for a free day pass or a free day office pass. Enjoy. Are you an early stage founder solving problems in the food supply chain? The Green Man Group sees the value in your work and has launched the Growing Further Awards to back your vision. These awards are designed to promote startups that are driving sustainability and innovation in key areas of the food supply chain, including production, distribution and retail, built environment, and customer engagement. Enter at growingfurther.io for a shot at a share of the €100,000 cash prize and the chance to pitch your company to a crowd of industry leaders. Don't miss out. The deadline for entries is October 4th, with final judging and the awards set for January 2025. Learn more and apply at growingfurther.io. Brian, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me, Gary.
Very, very welcome. You made the long journey up from Galway to join us today.
I'm actually a proud Longford man, settled in Galway for the last 6 or 7 years. That's where CitySwift is based. Love it down there. Great work-life balance.
So you're going to make buses great again.
That is the plan. I think marketing have it a little bit more fine-tuned. CitySwift, it's a performance optimization platform for the public transport industry. And what we do is optimize buses and public transport using data. We're making good traction as well.
Public transport is kind of one of those things that, like, it's kind of taken for granted a little. It's kind of like insurance, right? You don't think about it until you need it or if it's not working right. People tend to get, I took the train randomly. I did one of my experiments and I was like, right, I'm just going to take the train from Dublin to Rosslare, knock it off and just get the train back just to work. And I loved it. Mm-hmm. Big train fan. And I got off and I was like, that was amazing, blah, blah, blah. Put it on Instagram and they're like, I got about 10 replies straight away going, the Wi-Fi never works. It is never on time. Did it? I'm like, why are you so angry? People get really emotive about public transport.
It's one of those things where, I was an advisor that works with us, Bob Montgomery, who was on our board, and he said to us in the early days, like, buses are one thing, no matter what you do, you can never please everybody. Everybody wants to be collected at their front door and they want to be dropped to their front door, their office or their school or wherever it is. And given logistics and, you know, how it all works, that's impossible. And it is very hard to please everybody. I think the other thing that people don't understand is just the complexities of actually running and operating and planning a bus network. You're dealing with traffic. It's not like a train that has a fixed schedule, its own route. And, you know, you're in your own control. There's so many external factors that affect the bus network that make it really, really difficult to actually, you know, to run it in a kind of a reliable, efficient fashion. And traditionally, it's been a little bit left behind from kind of a tech innovation point of view. Low margin industry, a lot of it is either kind of privately run with low margins or it's in the public sector. And innovation historically has been kind of, it's been the last to get innovation, the last to get new technology.
Why? So
it has been left behind. I think it's probably, there's probably a couple of reasons to it. I think, look, investment, people within, when we were starting out first, I remember talking to a managing director of one of the biggest bus companies in the UK, and he was actually telling us at the time that the CFO in that bus company wanted to delete all the data that had been newly generated on all these buses. So, you know, 5-10 years ago, all these buses got new digital hardware, which is basically GPS receivers, so you can do the real-time information to how far away is the bus from bus stops. And then obviously all the ticket machines went digital, which is your Leap cards, your Oyster cards, you know, all this smart card based. Basically, that was going on. And with that, a massive amount of data. But they had 35,000 employees within this big PLC bus operator, and nobody knew how to actually analyze this data, how to do anything with it. And it was just really an industry where they focused on the operations, which is the engineering, the mechanics of the buses, purchasing the buses, and then the operations, which is the drivers, the supervising of that. And it's so operationally heavy. And, you know, if you look at that bus company in particular, they're running 6,500 buses every single day. Ryanair only run about 400 planes. So the amount of operations, the amount of drivers, the amount of bus stops, the amount of passengers that they're carrying.
So much happening, like, every day, like, hundreds of thousands of passengers getting on, getting off, small accidents, trees blow down. Like, I'm on a main bus route, like, and like, there must be 100 or 200 buses go by in a day, some of them with two people on them. And I always look at it and go, what? Like, it must be so difficult to plan and manage and even just run on a daily basis.
Yeah. And look, historically as well, and it's, look, it's one of the big reasons why we built CitySwift in the way we did and the problem we're trying to solve. But they didn't have the tools or the technology. Literally, a bus scheduler would go in and they would take the worst month of, you know, traffic patterns. So let's say probably usually September, October is generally school's back, everyone's driving, the winter's back, and that's when traffic is at its worst. So they would just go and take the running times, the variability from the worst month of the year, they'd add 10% onto that, and then they'd run that for the rest of the year. And the inefficiencies in that, you know, being completely undynamic. But the reason was they just didn't have the tools, technology to be able to do things any faster. So that's what they used to do. Loads of fat built into these kind of schedules. Didn't have the tools, technology to do it any different. And they ran the buses that way. And I think that's where, you know, a lot of the issues arose from. And historically then, they're unable to change based off that. Then we come along and basically we have this platform that figures out that Fridays are different than Thursdays, especially since COVID. You know, what's the difference when school's on, school's off, summer holidays, Easter holidays? And we've sped up the process from processing like terabytes and terabytes of data, then putting it into a scheduling system to get it to something's on the road that drivers and supervisors and operations teams can use. And what used to take maybe 2 weeks per route now takes 2 hours.
Right.
Which means these schedulers can make, you know, multiples of the schedule changes that they used to be able to do, which means they're moving to become more and more and more dynamic, which means increases in efficiency, but also increases in reliability at the same time, which is massive.
So what's the tech in a bus? Like, let's get kind of micro on this, let's get nerdy on it. Like, what's in a bus? Like, how does it kind of like talk to all that data, or how does it create all that data?
Yeah, so look, I think it was probably now, I would say the last 5 to 10 years, every single bus in basically the Western world has been fitted with about 2 or 3 different types of hardware that all have SIM cards built into them, and then they're connected to the cloud. One of them is what we call a vehicle location system. So there's GPS pings every 30 seconds, which is basically saying this bus is here at this moment in time, and we get transmissions of that every 30 seconds from every single bus, 24 hours a day, basically. Where is that bus? What is it doing? And how fast is it moving around? The other piece of data we get is the ticket machine. So when you go in and you tap your Leap card or you pay with cash or whatever you do, your bank card, there's a digital transaction that somebody boarded that bus at that time, at that stop, which is the second kind of key piece of data. The third is the schedule files. So that's what they're pre-planned, you know, you have this scheduling file, which it basically says the driver and the bus should be here at this time, on this date, in this vehicle, on this route, and doing this journey. And you have all that data. So if we, on a high level, put all them together, the schedule is what's meant to happen. The GPS pings is what actually did happen. And then the ticketing data is how many people were getting on and off that bus. And we're the first company in the world to actually stitch all them three data sets together. So nobody before had actually been able to join all these different data sets, enrich it, and bring all that data together. And then all the insights, the optimizations is built on top of actually cleaning and joining all this data under.
So what are you looking for in that data? Like what are you kind of like making tangible then out of that? Like, what are the key insights you pull out?
Look, there is multiple depending on the user and use case of it. So we have two kind of primary kind of use cases. One is for your private operator. And basically what a private operator is trying to do is take all that historical data. How long did it take to get from stop A to B to C to D on Fridays, on Thursdays, on Wednesdays, on Saturdays, when there was a match on in the Aviva, when UCD was off, when DCU was on, all of these different variables. And what they do is they build up what we call data profiles, so that's of historical data, and then they use them to make predictions about what's going to happen going forward. So a lot of what we're doing now is planning for September. Schools go back, traffic traffic gets way worse, what should the schedule be in reality to match as close to what's going to be in reality? So you're giving the most accurate schedule out to passengers to use. So that for a private operator, then they're kind of reducing unnecessary time, but making sure there's enough time within there so that buses are arriving on time and they don't go far behind, and then you don't have the issues with buses not turning up, etc. And the other thing is they're not too full, so you don't want them too empty, but you don't want them too full either. For a transport authority, it is quite different, where they're kind of looking at it from more an analytics approach to kind of go, where should we be putting investment? Where should we put bus lanes? So we're doing various kind of dashboarding reporting insights tools. One big one in the UK currently is we have a contract with Transport for Wales, so every single bus in the entire country of Wales is on the platform, and they're spending lots of time within the platform looking at basic average speed maps and seeing how full buses are. And basically they take a base of COVID data and how fast buses were able to move around when there was no traffic. They overlay what happened last week, last month, and then they see how full the buses were on a map at that same time. And basically what they're seeing is, where's the biggest delta between free flow and traffic to congested traffic now? And then where's what we call delay minutes? So how many people are being affected by that slowdown in the buses? And then they're looking at them pinch pointer areas around the entire country of Wales and going, we need to put bus priority measures in place.
I get you. So they're using bigger picture stuff. They, instead of like going, oh, we need to put 10 buses on it Thursday, they're looking at like, how do you infrastructurally change the whole thing?
It's the difference between kind of operationally trying to improve the operations versus strategically trying to improve the network and improve the overall.
I didn't think of that. I didn't think of the infrastructure, the bigger picture piece. For people listening, like, what are the insights they can use when they're traveling? Like, because, you know, how have things changed, I guess, since COVID? Because, like, we were chatting about it there. We're recording this on a Friday in Dublin City Centre. It's empty. We had a coffee on our own there in a big meeting room. Like, usually there's 20, 30 people in there. Like, what's changed since COVID?
I think the biggest thing for us is that there's a very obvious Tuesday to Thursday is very similar. It used to be Monday to Friday was all the same. One schedule, Monday to Friday, different one for Saturday, different one for Sunday. So everybody ran three schedules, weekday, and then one for each day of the weekend. Now we're seeing more and more in the major urban cities in the UK where they're running Friday-only schedules. And there's a difference in the peaks. The peak is earlier on Fridays. There's more people using buses for leisure on Friday evenings, and they're travelling in different patterns, I suppose. So there is lots of insights. Look, for passengers, I think the real benefit of potentially what CitySwift is delivering is actually having certainty around journey time. So I don't know if you've ever used Google Maps or any of these journey planners, but sometimes you go in and you say, look, I want to get from Lucan to City Centre, and it says it's going to take 45 minutes on a bus in a peak time or whatever it may be. And you get on the bus arrives on time, that's great, but you're sitting there and it's taken, you know, 65 minutes, not 45 minutes. And that means you're 10 minutes late for work. And you could have taken an earlier bus if you had any degree of certainty around your journey time. But what's happening there is that Google Maps is just taking the schedule that was given to them by the bus operator. The schedule is wrong, and then Google Maps is wrong, and then the passenger is getting wrong information. The result of that annoys everybody, because it annoys the passenger because they're late for work. It annoys the driver because he's gone into overtime and he's not getting his break after he's done his trip. And it annoys everybody else who was meant to be using the bus on its next trip when it comes back out of Dublin, because it's 10 minutes late already starting its next trip.
It's so weird you brought that up, because this last week's episode was with Arnie Kendi from The Smooth Company. And I ask, quickfire round at the end, you'll get it at the end. And I ask, like, what do you believe that other people will find strange? So Anya said, okay, this is strange, right? But I think Google Maps are like tricking people and bringing people strange ways for different reasons that we don't fully know. And I kind of laughed and went, yeah, good one. And I texted her before I put it up. And I was like, look, I'm putting that up now. It's probably going to get a lot of weird responses. It's done, I think, 1.3 million views so far. And the vast majority of people are going, you're dead right on you. So what is the truth? You can actually, life is funny, you can actually solve this for us right now.
Yeah, and I do have a little bit of an inside track here as well.
Hit me.
We were in Google's offices recently enough. We're doing workshops with some of our clients and we use their offices. But the Google Maps team, the head of UK, came in and actually explained some of that. So what they said they're trying to do is actually split traffic. So if there's two ways to go, that they're depending on traffic and whatnot, they're actually trying to split traffic. Their overall ambition seemingly is to try and reduce emissions. So if there's one route where it's taking a lot of stop starting and there's traffic, they'll try and divert other people onto another route of similar length. So they're actually trying to diversify or split traffic so it's not all going on one direction. And they're using real-time clever algorithms to kind of do that as well. But I would say you should be trying to use the bus, and then we get our emission savings from everybody using the bus rather than putting people down side streets and whatnot in cars.
It is strange. I use, and now I'm hyper aware of it, I use Waze and I use Google Maps and stuff. And like, Grant, I put it on all the time, even if it's just my normal journey home. And I just kind of want the easiest, nicest route to drive. Mm. And sometimes it'll always get you there, but sometimes it brings you the most strangest ways in the world. Mm. I remember I was in Spain last year, and it brought me down to this, like, the smallest road. And literally the car windows were touching, like, the buildings. Mm. And I was like, oh, my God.
It's sometimes the context of where they bring, especially in,
yeah,
in smaller, narrow streets. And, yeah, you have to be aware of the size of the vehicle you're driving and whatnot.
Yeah, it's bizarre. It's funny how you brought that up today. I'll text Tony after this. She'd be delighted. So, like, how the hell did you get into this? Because it's pretty niche.
It is very niche. So for two school friends from Longford to end up having probably the most advanced kind of public transport data optimization platform, it is very niche. And the story actually starts before I was born, and myself, my co-founder, Alan.
We're going right back here.
We're going right back. So 1980s, Longford, Alan's family business, his parents bought their first bus. So they bought, I think originally, a minibus to bring people back and forth to the show bands.
Oh, wow.
That was their, so they were charging, I think, a pound, a shilling per head, whatever it was back then, to bring people back into the concerts or the dances, I think, that used to go on. So that's where they got their first start. I think over the next kind of probably 10, 20 years, they built that up, Farley's Coaches at Loan Coaches, to be one of the largest, most professional bus operators in the Midlands, doing a lot of tour work, a lot of school work, a lot of private hire. So Alan literally grew up, you know, in a bus business. His backyard is a bus depot. And he grew up in the family business. The kitchen table was the boardroom table. And he learned the industry from there, I suppose. I think we grew up in a little village called Keena, just between Ballymattan and Longford Town. Alan was one side of the business, literally, you know, playing with buses. I was the other side of the village playing with computers. So we went to secondary school then, and we were best friends since we were 12. Went in, look, we're just normal kids in school and had a lot of fun along the way.
Just love buses.
Well, I, Alan, you can talk to him about his love for buses. I think he was taught from a very young age that they were probably, you know, not to love buses, as in a lot of bus operators in Ireland, they want to have the biggest fleet of buses. They want more and more and more and more buses. I think Alan's parents gave him a very good education that the bus is a means, and it's how do we make do as much as we can with as few buses as we can. Rather, it's not volume, but it's actually the quality of what we're doing and how do we make it more efficient? How do we improve the business, improve the margins of the business?
That's really interesting. And that's a straight line straight then to City Swift.
Exactly. So look, we went on a few curvatures along the way and a few detours, but it really was about 2 years after we both went to Dublin, did university, and probably like every good Irish story, it started with a conversation in a pub on a Friday night. Alan had gone back and was working full time in his family business, and he was looking at ways that he could improve the margins, you know, get these buses working at weekends, during the evenings and various other times. I suppose he had the domain knowledge, I had the tech skills. And at that time, we kind of brainstormed through a few ideas around. And we kind of, at the very most highest level, we came up with, let's build the Uber for buses.
It was of that period, right? Everyone's trying to build the Uber for everything, right?
It was 2016, 2015, 2016.
Peak Uber.
Let's
make Uber for X. Yeah,
exactly. It was Uber for everything. Ours, because it was transport, was, you know, and we had his domain skills, my tech skills, we were like, you know, maybe we can actually pull this off.
Why'd you want to start a business?
I'm not sure. Look, I came from more of a, obviously I had the tech background, but I actually came from an agriculture. So, you know, all parents, family, uncles, aunties were farming background. So I think Alan came from that family business, obviously knew how to work hard. I came from the farming background. It was a great upbringing. And look, farms are family businesses as well, to a certain extent. I think the reason we wanted to start City Swift at this time was, I think even in the early days, myself and Alan did believe that there was a big, massive opportunity in the technology for bus companies in his own family business, and even wider scale in any research we did, was way, way, way behind taxis or other industries, airlines, tangential industries. So big, massive market opportunity. And then because Alan had such that background, such that domain knowledge, mixed with, you know, my tech skills, we were less like, we, you know, genuinely believe we could pull something off here. And maybe it was naivety. Definitely probably was a lot of naivety in the early stages.
It's always naivety, though, because if founders didn't have that, they'd never start. I've never met a founder who didn't say that. Yeah. Like, because you have to be, because if you knew now what you knew then, or if you knew then what you knew now, it'd be like, oh, it's way too hard.
Exactly. And I think it's why a lot of first-time founders, you know, start with that, is that naivety. The other thing is, we had nothing to lose. We were, you know, young, mid-20s, had no debt, had no mortgages, had no dependents, family to support. So we could go, and we did, we went and lived for probably 3, 4, 5 years where we were bootstrapping.
What were you trying to do? Proper Uber percent. For buses, but it, what does that mean?
So it was business to consumer started with. So the general concept or idea was, we would build a website, an app, a user interface. People would come in and say, I want to go from here to here at these times. And we would, when if we had enough people who had crowdsourced, is what we would call it, a bus, then we would go and source a bus, subcontract a bus operator, bring them in, and then put on this service.
So you'd find the demand first,
yeah,
and then fill it.
And we had some intelligent algorithms built where, you know, when people were putting it in, people were able to keep, you know, in the loop around how many people, how full we needed the bus to be before we'd started.
Oh, cool, yeah.
And clever kind of geo-matching kind of stuff that we did. That's where we focused on, you know, in the vicinity, and with all these radiuses and various other algorithms built. Where it worked really, really, really well at the start was concerts. So if there was a big event happening in Crow Park, the Bruce Springsteens, the Garrett Brookses, the U2s of this world, you have 80, 90,000 people from all around the country, yeah, all descending on to one place at one time, and you work backwards from there and you put on scheduled services and you operate them. We did a bit of that in coordination with Alan's family business, Concert Bus, and some of that's still going on in Alan's business, our family business, and it worked really well. We made a bit of money. We learned a lot. Heavy operationally, took a lot of work, but...
Sounds like a lot of work.
It was a lot of work, a lot of people movement, but it did make money, it was profitable, and Alan's family buses and different bus operators we used around the country, the buses were sitting in the yards. So the hardest thing was to get drivers to come and do it in the evenings and weekends, but there was loads of buses. So
I can't think of a worse job than taking 90 to 100 people to a concert. That'd be grand, taking them home and listening to them for 2 hours back to Longford would probably be the most painful thing you could.
We did a lot of things, myself and Alan, in the early days. So like one of them was, we'd have our boards and our checklists, and we'd have everybody's name, and basically the bus drivers would be ringing us when they were missing 3, 4, 5 people who hadn't made it home from a One Direction concert and were kind of somewhere around Drumcondra, Fibsborough, and couldn't find their way back to a bus. So we did a lot of trying to you know, locate people and things like that. But look, we learned a lot there, and it made sense. I think the big thing is, we were ambitious. We wanted to build a global company. We wanted this to be something that, you know, we could support us, that we could go and get outside investors to fund.
Why?
And be scalable.
Why did you want to build a big one?
I think we were just ambitious. Like, it's from the early days, we wanted to build. And maybe it's that whole the Uber side of things, that kind of rocket ship growth, and you know, we wanted to build something that was scalable internationally. That was our aim. Wasn't to build another Farley's Coaches, another bus company. You know, Alan already had one of them in Longford. He could have gone home and ran. And I think that was always the thing. It's like, this, what we're building has to be something that's going to be much, much bigger and can grow to be something that's scalable and much, much bigger. So we were looking for that scalable, repeatable business model. And concerts wasn't that.
Boom time in the summer, and then winter you're just kicking your heels.
Exactly. So couldn't support a team, couldn't support the company. We went from there with the B2C to looking at more regular. So like, where could we get regular service? And we looked where, let's say, there wasn't fixed rail lines, there wasn't good public bus services available. In areas we identified, one of them originally was kind of like the Lucan. There's a lot of new houses built there. And then like City West, and there was the business park, and there's obviously so many people travelling from or to. And if we put on, you know, a bus service and went out, could we get buses full enough to put on this service and then into town as well and do direct services there? So we actually started where we got myself and Alan and a couple of friends from school that were living in Dublin, and we went out with leaflets and basically knocked on doors in Lucan and talked to loads of people, gave them the leaflets, told them about the service. I would say everybody, every door we knocked on, people said, this is great, really want to use this, great service we have here. But when we turned up with a bus at 9 o'clock in the morning, the amount of people that were using it, or the amount of people put it through the website, you know, it was quite low. And it was taking an awful lot of time to try and build the demand up to make these services profitable. And I think we looked at the unit economics of it, of what we were trying to do, and it just didn't make sense. The amount of capital it would cost to actually, you know, start a new bus route from scratch to get it up to where you're trying to, you know, get profitability on that, and then to put on the frequency, it was going to be a big, big challenge, along with the marketing costs, along with the tech costs, the R&D costs. And we wanted to do things better, like we were trying to disrupt, basically. What we did at that stage is we turned around and looked at all the other buses that were going around Dublin, and went, how the amount of money it's costing to run these buses, and call it the average, be average, it costs about a quarter of a million every single year to run a bus service between fuel, driver's wages and depreciation.
Wow.
Every single bus, quarter of a million. There's about 1,000 buses, over 1,000 buses in Dublin these days. And we could see that there's so much, you know, inherent inefficiency built up into these bus services, the way they're operated, the way they're ran, and also, you know, the problems in the passenger experience that everybody knows about, and reliability and buses going missing, etc. So we kind of took a, you know, should we go B2B, should we go selling this to enterprise? And we tried, you know, initially in Ireland, and we kind of looked around, but I think our big break at that stage was actually to get over to the UK, and we met with a guy called Bob Montgomery, who was a former CEO of Dublin Bus, but at this stage he was the managing director of the largest PLC in the UK, a company called Stagecoach, and they ran 6,500 buses. And basically what Bob said to us that day, we met him in Birmingham, he said to us that they've installed all this new digital hardware on all their buses. There's terabytes and terabytes and terabytes of data coming off it, you know, every single day, and the CFO wants to delete all of that data. And we just turned around to Bob, and he looked at us and goes, if I give you a sample of that data, can you help me to improve the efficiency of my bus network and to improve the passenger experience for all the passengers using it? And we were like, we definitely can. And at that point, it was a real, I remember myself and Alan flying home from that meeting where we knew we had something. It was, everything before then was, we were got little success, but we kind of knew in our hearts of hearts, this wasn't a scalable, repeatable business model. Whereas we looked at them and went, 6,500 buses, what's their P&L? They're turning over £2 billion sterling annually. Their cost base is 1.6 billion that's been spent on driver's wages, fuel, wow, and their operating expenditure. If we were to save a couple of percent of that, which we were back at the fag pack at Matt's, we were very confident we could do, we could have a massive impact here.
How did you get to meet Bob?
It was actually a connection through the Ryan Academy, the CEO of Ryan Academy. And it's actually a one, two-step removed kind of connection. It was a friend of the CEO of the Ryan Academy at that time, when DCU was a friend of Bob's. And when they heard what we were doing and the B2C thing, they said they had this friend over in the UK that was the managing director of a bus company.
Nice.
Did we want to meet him? It's serendipity. It's these things happen, I suppose.
But it's being in the game, and I always talk about this in the pod. It's being in the game. It's never linear. Like we talked about this earlier about life. Like you can plan it in this lovely linear fashion, and it's just life is not linear, and business is definitely not linear. And it's always, but it's just about being in the game, isn't it? Staying alive long enough and finding, like, the idea. You just have to start somewhere in the vague. A guy came up to me last week. He goes, "I really want to start my own business." He says, "I don't know what I want to do." I was like, "What are you passionate about?" He goes, "Electric cars." I was like, "Well, just start there. Just go as deep as you can into the electric car space and you'll figure it out."
Yeah, and I think it's making a bit of noise as well. It's like when that early stage, myself and Alan, they were doing a couple of buses to concerts. We were trying to do these buses from Lucan to City West. On the grand scale of things, it's pretty minor stuff that we were doing, but we were making a bit of noise about it on the social media, you know, at the various events. We were entering awards, and we were just making noise so that other people tangential to us were able to see what we're doing, and then they were making connections for us, which, you know, when you're starting out, them little things
have a
big, massive impact. I think once you get more of a mature of a business, you know, it's not the same like that. It's more delivering on your numbers, it's execution.
It is, but people, and I say this with the best of intentions to a lot of like young entrepreneurs, I mean, like, no one cares about your business. Mm. Nobody cares, genuinely. They're probably not even listening to you. So you have to say it 100,000 times.
Yeah.
When you say 100,000 times and you think you've like reached it, start again, because people aren't really listening.
Yeah.
Oh, what does Brian do? Oh, something in buses,
fixes the buses. So.
Yeah, something concerts, something. But you know, even just to get into like the bus guy, whatever it is, the podcast guy, having that moniker, and then people go, oh, yeah, I need to meet whoever. That's the, and I love teasing out those little details about you, of like, how do you meet Bob? Because it's always those little details that matter
And have a massive impact as well.
Exactly. Change the course of your entire business.
Yeah, 100%. It definitely sped up that journey. We may have ended up there, but it might have taken a lot longer. Would we have survived?
You know, exactly.
Hard to know, especially during them periods back then. I think the bank account went to zero maybe 3 times.
Yeah.
The company bank account. So, you know, them things have a monumental impact. And I think it was also instilled belief into me and Alan that we were on the right track.
Yeah.
If we were, this is the biggest bus company in the entire of the UK. If they're like this, then everybody else is like that. You know, we have a big market here to go after.
I want to tease it. The next thing I want to talk to you about is acting then with ruthless power at that exact point, because we were having a coffee earlier and we were talking about like the world is really noisy and there's lots of like this going on and that going on. How did you know that that was the moment? How did you pick out going, that's the signal we need?
I think myself and Alan probably, we had put a lot of energy, a lot of work into building the tech, doing the marketing, whether it was in person, knocking on doors, operating the buses for the various events and scheduled services and various other things we had done. A lot of, you know, energy had gone into it. And we were probably at the point where we were like, we need to move to B2B. We need to try and optimize the already existing networks that were there. But it was how do we go about doing that? Where do we start? Where do we build a team? How do we do enterprise sales? We have to build probably a completely new iteration of a data platform or a platform to go and do this. And I think we probably didn't have a leg up to go and do that. And it was going to be very hard to start that in Ireland, where you had the kind of more publicly ran bus companies. And it would have just been hard to get deals done when you're basically nobody's to go and do that. So I think it was that moment where we met Bob. He kind of gave us the olive branch. He put out the hand and goes, and we had data sent over to us in the next week or two after that. Times have changed a lot, but it actually, the first bit of data we ever got from Stagecoach came on a USB that was sent on post, and Bob had to send somebody from their headquarters in Manchester, their central office in Manchester, down to Oxford to actually plug in a USB, download the data and send it to Galway.
That's funny. And that's not even that long ago. It just shows you how things are evolving so fast.
2017, 2018, wow. That was. Look, it was, there probably was other ways to do it at that point, but that was the path of least resistance for Bob and team internally to get it over to us.
So like, when you think about this broader, like, there's so much data being produced every day. I was only thinking about this recently, like, even us as humans, individuals, we're producing so much data every day in our phones and just all the stuff we do, and having Google Maps on is producing data, having this on is producing data. Like, how do you guys think then about, like, distilling it down, because you must get so much, like, what's your thought process to bring it down to actionable insights?
Yeah, it's actually probably been the biggest challenge for us, is actually what we do with the underlying data. So from all them various sources of data, it's basically not every bus company, but every different ticketing supplier has different formats of ticketing data. Every different kind of region, country has different formats of scheduling files, timetabling files. The GPS pings come in different formats of various JSON, XML, all these different technical formats. Sometimes we get them live in real time. Sometimes the bus has to wait till it goes back to its depot and downloads the data onto a central piece of hardware, and then it comes over to us. And that could be 1 day late, 2 days late, 3 days late. We have got, and it's probably, you know, world leaders at the ability to able to handle all of these diverse siloed data sets that come in various degrees of real time and lag. And then because they're all siloed, they're different data sets, we standardize them and then we stitch them together.
Right.
What we call the joining process and then the enriching process that goes on after it. I think we've had some examples and case studies where bus companies had suppliers before who were trying to do a bit of this joining, and they might be able to join 60, 70, 80% of the data, but 20, 30% of it was thrown in the bin. Oh. So if you're trying to analyze a bus network and there's 20 or 30% of the buses missing, it's very hard to you know, make better, good decisions. What we're able to do pretty much in the UK now, because we have all these integrations built and in Ireland as well, is it's plug and play. So if I was to sign a deal with you today, with your bus company, by the day after tomorrow, 2 days' time, I'm pretty confident I could have the platform up and running and there'd be 99.5% of that data will be fully in there, fully accurate, fully tested and high quality. And that alone, all stitched together, is probably the biggest USP in CitySwift that we've been able to do in the UK so far. And it's why we're the most advanced. Once we have that clean, rich, joined data set built underneath, then we're able to build all these cool things on top of it that add so much value to the bus companies. The fact, one example is, before we came along, no bus company ever knew where passengers were getting off the bus. So what we went and did is took all the smart card data. So if you're getting on the bus out in Greenstones this morning at 8:30, and then you're getting on the bus again in St. Stephen's Green at 5:30, and you do that 1, 2, 3 days in a row, we can tell then that you're getting off the bus in the morning.
I was going to say, how the hell do you work that out? But yeah, it makes sense.
It's trip chaining. And if you're doing multiple legs of tram journeys, Lewis journeys, bus journeys, and mix that all together, we're able to trip chain all that up. We have an algorithm built that will do that. And then we're able to tell bus companies where people are getting off the bus. But what we're also do is how full, because you have a really long bus route, people can get on and off and on and off. So the bus, it's very hard to tell beforehand how full it was at any one point along that journey. But now with this extra piece of data that we're able to do through all this enrichment that we're doing, now there's all this new insights that's been able to glean from it. And then matching supply and demand becomes a lot easier, more profitable, more efficient, etc.
That's wild. There must be tons of industries like this.
There probably is, and people always say, you know, is there any other industries, airlines, other forms of transport, etc. We're bus experts. You know, obviously Alan's background, Bob, who was the managing director of Stagecoach, joined our board after he left Stagecoach as well. So loads of industry experience. But we actually hired probably another 10 people from industry. So the length and breadth of the UK, we have people who used to work in these bus companies, living in Aberdeen, Portsmouth, Newcastle, Birmingham, that are working for CitySwift. So we are bus experts.
Even outside buses though, regardless of your own industry, like parking that for a second, what other industries do you think? Because I feel the world is still very analog. Like you walk around the city, you know, people are, we were laughing earlier about like AI this, AI that, people are obsessed with AI. But to me, I kind of look at it and go, we still live in a very analog world. Like,
it's the way I look at it a little bit is the pre-AI stuff is where could we collect data that we're not collecting data, or there's data being generated that we're not analysing. And I think AI comes after all of that.
Yeah.
Because if we're not collecting the data, or we're not, we don't know how to use the current data we have, then it's very hard to put an AI model on top of it. And I think there's probably lots of areas that I see. Most of them are probably relative to cities and to, you know, traffic patterns, you know, and city management and various other areas like that is where I would be looking at it. How people are moving around cities outside of buses in general is areas where I would be looking and thinking there's so much opportunity here. But look, there's definitely other industries that, you know, I wouldn't be as deep down or as knowledgeable on where there's so much ongoing. Agriculture is one, have a bit of background in, you know, again, historically there's been very little data being collected. It's very, not even analog, it's, you know, off the grid basically, but there definitely is opportunities there for optimization, for collecting data, for insights built on top of it. But look, I think you're right, there's lots of other industries as well. I would say probably transport and buses probably has been a little bit behind the like of airlines, the like of taxis.
Yeah.
They're a little bit ahead for various reasons. But look,
I think there's so much growth though to be done in this area. Like you made two great points there about like, it's either the data has been collected or it's definitely not been analysed. I think it's definitely not been analysed because even with your phone, like you have so many touch points a day, you pay for this, you go here, you get your receipt, it's emailed to you, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of it feels very disjointed. Mm. You're kind of, then you have to download the receipt and upload it to this expenses thing. I do feel we still live in a very disconnected world. So it's really interesting to see how you're applying this model and how like it could be applied broader, like this thinking of just like, even what you said there about like knowing when someone gets off the bus, just taking very logical but smart steps to go, well, we can pretty much predict they're getting off there. They're not running the final 2 miles to Stephen's Green.
And the other piece as well, like from Widows, we're using that to optimize buses. But if you take the entire city of Birmingham, we're fully rolled out. We have 500,000 people a day moving around on Birmingham, and we know where they're getting on a bus and where they're getting off buses, so where they're going from and to. It's kind of good, our data, because it's naturally anonymized, aggregated. It's not house to work, it's bus stop to bus stop. But that's half the people movements in the entire city of Birmingham. Like, how useful is that for other industries to know, from a retail perspective, from a property perspective, from a government perspective, to know how and when people are moving? It's also the niches on it. Is it different when it's raining than when it's sunny? You know, there's various other probably indicators within that data that could be used, where they need to empty bins more. You know, people go to the beaches. There's loads of insights that can probably be gleaned from that data outside of the way we're using it. And I think there's probably a lot of kind of tangential industries where things are happening like that. The data's been used for one purpose, but if there's a way, and I think it has to be done in the right way, anonymized, aggregated, etc. But if we bring that data up, how can it be used? I think a good example back to Google Maps is they had, during COVID, they were able to share kind of the people movements index, because they obviously have Google Maps, and they were able to kind of say, look, this is how much people are moving in cities and how little they're moving during lockdowns. And they were able to kind of share that data, the very anonymized, aggregated, and, you know, bird's eye view of cities. But I think there's an awful lot of value to be gained in that real world people movement data.
What do you think the future of cities is? Because we talked about it briefly earlier, but after COVID, you know, the Monday, Friday thing, either from your own data or just from your own opinion, what do you think the future of cities is now?
I think it depends where in the world we are. Like the Irish, UK, European model is, and I think there's a big movement towards more walkable cities, active travel, public transport, and away from cars, and having cars in our city centres. And I think that's going to continue. It's going to have to continue because congestion, there's just not enough space for all these cars with our population growth that we have and will be having in the future. And then obviously climate's a big, massive thing. The pollution from all these private vehicles is, you know, it's chronic. And the current public transport that's in place, you know, there's already so much of a saving by using, you know, shared sustainable public transport. But what we're seeing is the fleets are going electric way faster in public transport than they are in private transport. All of our clients, public, private, you know, 2030, I would say nearly every single bus is going to be electric or hydrogen or whatnot. I think on top of that, New York, for the first time, end of June, they're introducing congestion charges in Manhattan. So anybody who drives into Manhattan are going to be paying this $15, basically, very like what they've done in London.
Yeah.
More and more cities are moving towards that. We're seeing it in the UK, big, small cities. Mayors are going to be taking back more control of cities in the UK, and potentially might be happening here in Ireland as well. And I think there's going to be a movement that cities are built for people, the people who live there, not for cars driving around. And it can be quite divisive. It's like more bus lanes, less car lanes. You know,
it does divide people. I was going to ask you that, like, because in theory, that's utopian and lovely that, you know, we'd have bus ever and trams ever and you can cycle everywhere. But even when you look at Dublin, like, it's fairly messy.
I believe it's carrot and stick. So the stick is congestion charging, more bus lanes, less car lanes, make it, you know, more of an inconvenience, parking levies, all these kind of types of things. That's the stick. There has to be carrot, because I get, look, if public transport is terrible, if it's impossible to use, if it doesn't turn up in time, it's not available, you know, it takes twice as long. You can't, it's very hard to force people to do that. So we have to make public transport way, 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 way better, and active transport and all them other forms, then to de-incentivize, you know, give the stick for private transport, but the carrot for public transport. And I think you probably have to go first with the public transport and then the stick there afterwards. It is tricky and it is divisive. I do think technology can play a part in that, in how we manage it, because there's sometimes where it makes sense to give the bus loads of priority, to give active transport low priority. And it's like sometimes we go and it's a hammer blow. It's like, right, that road's a bus lane now and cars are never allowed in there ever again, where at certain times of the week, at certain times of the day, it makes sense to probably open it up because there's no buses in there for X, Y, and Z reason. But we're a little bit with how we manage traffic back to where we were with buses, very undynamic. It has to be the one way. There's no flexibility. There's no dynamic nature to it. So I do think that's a big area for growth in the future as well.
How have you funded this? Because this sounds like an expensive business.
Yeah, so look, I think probably back to the when we first met Bob and went B2B enterprise, I think that was when we really set out that we have a big business potential here. The market size is big. You looked at the kind of key players in the UK, the potential impact we could deliver by saving them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% of their OPEX every year. The numbers were large. So there's a big, massive market opportunity. And it was feasible enough that we could get there and optimize it. I think what we realized at that stage is we were going to have to put a lot of money into R&D to build this platform out, and a lot of money into enterprise sales of and enterprise customer success, customer support, and all the things that go along with that, marketing and everything else. So we went out looking for funding. I think myself and Alan, I'll call it strategic, but maybe it wasn't. We went, who were the best people in Ireland who could help to fund this business and help us grow this business? And I think two areas came up. One was airlines, where obviously Ireland has a rich heritage of the whole airline industry, where the innovators.
It's mad the impact that Irish people have had on aviation. I had Deck Ryan on recently, and it's only when you sit back and look at the Ryanair story, it's mental the impact Irish people have had on airlines in broader sense as well.
Well, that's it. And it's even pre-Ryanair with GPA and aircraft leasing, and even post-Ryanair when Viva and the various other airlines around the world. So it's insane. And what's that done for the Irish economy, both from that kind of aircraft leasing point of view and you know, Shannon as a hub as well down there, great airport. But also Ryanair and the people movement around Europe, the Dublin, we can just get anywhere in Europe relatively cheaply. I have to go for a there's a conference on in Brussels, and I was looking at flights, and 20th of June it's €40 return with Ryanair.
It's crazy. I don't think we appreciate it. I don't think we get it. I think because especially people who've grown up younger, or younger people who've had Ryanair all their lives, you don't get like how cheap that is. I think we still overlook and kind of go £40 a grand, or you go to London, it's like £100 return, and you're like, that's mental.
It is. It's massive. And I think as an island nation like we are, it's connected us to Europe. And you know, even everything that's gone on with Brexit recently and whatnot, the fact that we have these direct links into Europe has been very beneficial. So, you know, I think it's absolutely massive, the airline industry and what it's done. But
you met Deck. So
we were in the Ryan Academy and we said, look, where's the best people? What's the best approach to try and get funding into this business? And obviously the venture capital is the trodden path to go down. And we did explore that route, but we also went the airline industry, and there was two areas we looked at, the whole Ryanair, Ryan kind of angle to it. And then obviously the other one was kind of Carter, because they had built a big enterprise sales, selling tech to all these airlines around the world, and obviously had a massive business doing that and lots of experience we thought we could learn from. So we were in the Ryan Academy. Thankfully, we got the opportunity to pitch in front of Deck. We compared all the public transport bus metrics to the airline metrics, to the Ryanair, the low-cost carrier, how efficient they are, what's the amount of passengers they carry, how full their seat utilization is. We compared that to the bus industry and it was stark.
Okay, so you use Ryanair as like, this is best in class and this is the problem we're solving.
Exactly.
Very clever.
And if we could improve some of the metrics to get a little bit better, like Ryanair had done, turnover times much, much quicker, and various other pieces like that, you know, the impact that we could have on the OPEX of these bus companies, Deck got it instantly.
So you tailored your pitch to
exactly
Deck, so he knew
to the audience.
Startups need to do that more. They need to be more specific. Sometimes you watch pitch and you're like, you've delivered this 1,000 times and it's so boring.
And for us, like, we didn't go scattergun when we were looking for funding. It was very deep focused. And we tried to get 1, 2, 3 people on board and then build from there. So Deck was the first one to believe in us. You know, he understood there's similar types of software in the airline industry to optimize, you know, routes and route planning and crew scheduling, etc. So he really got it. From there, I managed to blag our way into Car Trotter's offices at the time, Bobby Healy was still in Carrotrawler, and he took a meeting with us, and myself and Alan went in and basically told him the story, told him where we'd got to. And look, he was really interested, really believed in the idea. He was busy, so he introduced us to the former CEO of Carrotrawler, Mike McGarrity, who came on board as an investor and chairman, has been phenomenal help to myself and Alan and the leadership team at CitySwift. So he sits as chair on the board. The experience he brings is just an operator in scaling, you know, an organization. He brought them from 10 people to over 600 people. So he's gone on that journey before. And then we went and got ACT as well. So the venture capital company here in Dublin. And they've been a great partner throughout. So them, that kind of core tree, along with Enterprise Ireland and the Western Development Commission, has been our kind of core investor group through the first 4 or 5 years, basically. So we did kind of our seed series A with them.
When was that?
Seed was in 2018. Series A was 2021. And last year we did our kind of series B round, where we got a London-based investor, Gresham House, in. And that was our series B. So we've raised 15 million to date.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Now I see where the money's come from. Okay. Yeah. I was listening to you going, Jesus, this sounds extremely complicated. That's a lot of data nerds crunching a lot of numbers.
What we say to everybody, it's like basically every single city in the UK, their entire public transport data comes over through the cloud to Galway. And we have 30 or 40 software engineers and data scientists crunching all that to turn it into something, the optimizations back out.
That's savage. Jesus, that's absolutely massive. So what's the end goal here?
I think for me and Alan, our ambition has been to turn this into a global business. The UK has been kind of our home country. Recently, we've got back and signed our first deals in Ireland, so Translink and Belfast and Bus Éireann, which we're extremely excited about and proud of. But the UK and Ireland, look, that's home. Where's next? And I think for myself and Alan, we really have that ambition to get into kind of further countries, further regions, further continents. The buses in every single city in the world. The buses are all similar. So the platform, from an optimization analytics point of view, will work in all of these countries. There is localization needed on the data and different data formats, but we've had to get over that in the UK. So
When you think about it, a bus is a bus, right? It's really interesting. Just as you said that there, I was just thinking about all the different countries. I was like, yeah, they're all kind of the same. Mm. They all do the same job. It's a very unusual industry in that, like, no matter what country in the world you go to, you get on the bus and it's kind of the same.
Yeah.
That's huge potential.
There's huge potential. I think the challenges to internationalization for us is, one, the data. So the data formats, data integrations, data systems, which is a technical problem that we will and should be able to solve. The other challenge that we've come across, and it's a little bit of the secret sauce to being able to scale the platform to date, is the adoption from users. So historically, working within the bus industry and working within, it's usually people who've been in the same job or similar jobs doing for the last 20, 30 years. They've been doing it one way. They haven't had much change. They haven't had much new technology. And a lot of times they feel that they know best. And why do I need to change? And I think for us, when we first started trying to scale CitySwift back in 2018, 2019, it was a massive challenge to actually get them to use the optimizations, to use the platform.
Yeah. I heard a great phrase recently: mediocrity is the enemy of great. Mm. If it's not awful, it's not brilliant, it's kind of grand.
Yeah.
It's very Irish, it's kind of grand. It's not broken to the point that people are screaming at them, but it's not like the best service in the world either. It's just kind of okay. This is those immortal words, this is how we've always done it.
It's why change, and you know, the effort involved in changing. And so, and I remember it was one of our earlier clients in National Express Group, and it was the head of networks there. From day one, he was an early adopter, innovator, real believer in the platform. But he turned around to myself and Alan at one stage, and we were a little bit disheartened. We couldn't get these bus schedulers to use the platform, and we put so much time and effort into it, and we're doing everything they told us to do. And he really told us, he was just like, this is winning their hearts and minds. You're coming in, they're covetous over what they do. They're trying to protect it. And it's a little bit like,
I'll be a little bit scared as well.
A little bit scared. It was a little bit like, people these days, and it's like, oh, is AI going to take our jobs? And there's a little
bit. They took our jobs. It's a little bit like that.
You know, who are these little whiz kids coming in?
Well, I suppose if they think, Jesus, if an algorithm could do the schedule, that's kind of my job.
It is to a certain extent. The problem, or, you know, it's not a problem, but the thing we quickly figured out was we could produce an answer through the platform using all the data in the world and bring it in and give an answer. And our answer is, it's what would have taken them 2 weeks to do, they can do in 2 hours in our platform, even quicker to give them the initial results. It's maybe even 30 seconds for the thing to spit out. This is what the data, the platform exactly said. They have this local knowledge that no platform is ever going to get. They know where the school is. They know that a bus has to be outside the school at 10 past three during school term. They know that there's a cricket pitch up that road and that there's a reason why. There's traffic lights, there's roadworks. Yeah. There's non-data, non-computer readable information, local knowledge that we didn't have. And they were right. So one of the features we built into the platform is they're actually able to overwrite the whole platform. They're able to go into every single piece of it and go, actually, we should change this time. We should do this in here. We should do that inside there and tag it and then rerun the simulation on it to say what the output is, what difference that's going to be for the platform. But it was a big, massive change in adoption. But it really took hiring local domain experts who used to working these jobs to go in and work with these people to understand, then to build a platform to give.
Well, they knew how they thought, right? You know, hunter, turn, gamekeeper, that approach. They know how they thought. And I think that's a really interesting point you made there. And I think that's the flaw with a lot of people's thoughts about AI. They have like, oh, it's going to do check over humans and blah, 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 blah. Such a lazy, weak argument, whereas you're always going to need that interpretation and the application. You need humans to actually go and drive the bus for now. Flying cars, right?
Yeah.
Come by 2020. We did a conversation earlier. You were getting predictions a few years ago going, Lance, you're wasting your time. Sure, automated cars are going to be here in a few years. Yeah. I think that one's safe enough for a while.
Yeah. This is, look, and I think we probably all get, you know, caught up on the hype curve a little bit.
A little bit.
But I really believe what we did and what our platform is now, it's an assistant to the humans to make better decisions. We've made them people more productive. They used to make 3 schedule changes a year. Now they're making 12 and it helps them in their decision making. A lot of the time they have the hunches and our platform is just, you know, a tool for them to be able to kind of guarantee that their hunches are right and speed up that process. And what we've seen is that now our platform, we're actually strongest with some competitors and stuff, and they're selling a pipe dream to executives that's non-feasible, not realistic, where we're actually down with the users. And our platform, the users love it now. It's fully adopted. It's you know, really good. And they're actually pushing it up, and they're our biggest advocates and biggest champions. But it really did take winning their hearts and minds. And I think that's going to be the challenge for us internationalizing, is how can we do that?
I was going to ask you, what's next? Like, what do you want to do next? Like, in the next kind of 18 to 2 years, where do you want to be?
I think there's opportunities in a lot of places, because, look, there's buses everywhere. I think probably for us, the areas where potentially the most attractive is kind of where is our clients already operational? And where is the bus industry most like the UK? So your former Commonwealth regions, Europe, etc. There's lots of our clients who have operations there. We can go from doing deals in the UK with them. We've proven it out. Platform's working really well. Let's go and follow them into Europe and potentially kind of Australia, New Zealand and the various parts of the former Commonwealth and Middle East.
Nice. It's an interesting stage of your journey. I'm going to do a quick fire round.
Brilliant.
What book would you recommend every entrepreneur read?
Yeah, so there's a book I read and it was recommended by Gillian French, who was the chief people officer in Caratrawler. It's called Who, and it's a method for hiring. And we read it in the early days. I think one of the biggest challenges for first-time founders, early founders, is hiring your leadership executive team. And this book puts out a kind of a 4-stage process on how to do that, both from building a pipeline, selection, assessment, and right through to kind of, you know, incentivization at the other end of it. And what we've done now is all our hiring managers have to read this book, and we're all singing off the same hymn sheet when we're going hiring. And it's had a monumental impact of getting the right people into the business.
Class. We'd never had that one recommended either. Very specific. I like that. What's something you have to learn the hard way?
Probably. Sometimes myself and Alan were probably overly optimistic and we jump into things like probably, you know, entrepreneurs do. It's just like, we have a vision, let's just go and do it. And the details have to follow. And I think when we were probably earlier stage, we believed that everything was going to take, you know, a fraction of the time it actually took. And we could conquer the world in a year and whatnot. And I think by bringing people like Mike McGeerty and others around, proper operators, we've turned into kind of, we're so operationally focused and execution focused now. And I think it was a big learning curve for us that, you know, to go from this kind of big strategic thinkers down to the operational execution, get things done. Now, I think we're kind of coming out the other end of it where we need to get a bit more strategic and, you know, how do we do this new market entry in other areas? But you have to be, I think, in the early days, really focused on execution and operations. Because at the end of the day, if you don't hit the big milestones, get the deals done, hit your numbers, you know, it's okay in early stages of a business, but once you're getting up to Series A, Series B, it's all about the numbers.
What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
Look, I think there's probably lots of things. You know, myself and Alan started the business when we were probably 24, 25, 26. When all our friends were going, traveling South America, doing all that kind of stuff, me and Alan were probably in a sitting room in Athlone, coding away and plotting and planning how we were going to take over the bus world and build this technology platform. So I think there was a lot of that where we did probably miss the last end of our 20s. We were poor, we had no money. And to be honest, we were so into what we were doing, we didn't really care. Look, I think the friends, family, probably miss family holidays, miss family occasions, miss friends occasions. I think, look, you can catch up on that stuff as well, but that's probably the biggest sacrifice.
What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
I think, look, the first thing I'd probably do is buy my mother a house by the sea. So we grew up in Longford. Nice. Very landlocked county. I think the nearest beach is probably an hour and a half away.
nice lake house, maybe.
That's it. Well, look, there's lots of lakes. Her big thing is she wants to kind of retire and live by the sea. So that's probably the first thing I do. I think the second thing would be, I think I've got to a stage where I used to be very risk averse in all walks of life, but I'd probably do something really boring with it. Property, you know, really boring investments. And the logic I would have is that, you know, my professional life, I have so much risk in there and I want to keep risking, you know, as the entrepreneur, I want to keep going and growing and building more and going faster. And by de-risking the personal life, it actually makes it easier to take more calculated risks in your professional life so that you can grow faster and do more.
That's an interesting answer. We haven't had that one yet. You'd be super boring in with your 10 million, but you'd be extra risky in your business. I like that. What's something in your daily routine you wish you started sooner?
Yeah, it's definitely the morning routine of going to the gym. So I joined one of these fancier high-end gyms down in Galway, Power Gym. Run by the Dean Group. So it opened a year or so ago.
Ben is a big power member.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's you know, in Galway, it's probably without doubt. So you have your morning fitness classes, you have sauna, ice bucket and all the other stuff, the instructors there. So I'm doing that probably the last 12, 18 months. And it's like a superpower. You do that first thing in the morning. I don't need coffee anymore. I'm into the office at 9
Don't
o'clock.
Go too far now, Brian. Don't lose the run of yourself, okay?
The coffee comes about 11. I don't need the first thing in the morning. But I wouldn't have been a morning person before that. But through the ups and downs of the entrepreneurial roller coaster, having that routine, every time I'm in Galway, go and do that, kickstart the day. It means you can just get through the ups and downs a lot easier. But
I think environment is important as well. Having somewhere nice to do that matters. If you're going and it's a slog and the gym's a bit of a shithole, it's much harder. Whereas you go in, it's quite nice. It definitely makes it easier. You got to remove friction
definitely.
Wherever you can. I'm going to give you 1 million euro. You can only invest in one person or company. Who is it?
Look, it can't be City Swift. So I think the other company.
And don't sit on the fence now.
Yeah, I won't. So our chairman, Mike McGeerity, he started a new company a year or two ago called Mealy.
Oh, you're going to get brownie points.
Yeah, look, you build up trust. So we're working with Mike for the last 5 or so years. He's been exceptional in our business and helping us. So look, if there's any person I'd give the money to, he's given us money.
You're
so
going to throw him a Mealy. Go on, give him a proper shout out. What's the company?
It's Mealy. M-E-I-L-I.
Oh, I know.
Himself and Bobby. Yeah,
I know it. I don't think those two ads are going to need a million. I think
that's the problem.
They'll be fine without it.
They mightn't take it, but yeah, look. Yeah. If they let me put it in, I'd put it in there.
If you had to start a new company in the morning, what would it be?
Yeah, I probably think there's, look, one area is, it's tangential to what we do at the minute, but on a wider scale, you have AI and you have all these large language models. The actual data going into all these things. And I think there is people trying to do it, but it's data trust, the data integrity, how we monitor all that. Because at the end of the day, if you're using ChatGPT and you get an answer at the other end that's wrong, it's because the data that's gone in is wrong. And I've seen firsthand in what we do, the amount of dodgy data that's out there, bad hardware, things don't match up, whatever it is. I would say around the world, we're only going to be creating more and more and more data. There's only going to be more and more dodgy data and platform for dealing with all of that, so that, you know, all the insights, all the other use cases down the line don't get polluted from bad data, bad input data. I think there's a massive market there.
That's cool. Data verification. That makes a lot of sense, actually, when you map it out like that, because people go mad if ChatGPT is wrong. You're like, it's just working on what we gave it. Like, it's really interesting. What do you believe that other people find strange or strongly disagree with?
AI isn't going to take human jobs. The kind of analogy I'll use is driverless cars. You mentioned it earlier, but when we were starting City Swift first, we went to a couple of VCs and we said, look, bus optimization platform, you know, make buses better. And a couple of the more, you know, rocket ship VCs, let's say, said, but all cars are going to be driverless by 2020. Nobody's going to need to use these
buses
anymore.
When was this?
This was 2018. 2017, 2018. And like, we
love the enthusiasm, yeah. Lads, but...
Yeah, so like, look, and the analogy here is that driverless cars obviously haven't matured in that way. We do have park assist, we do have lane assist, we have all these things that's useful in cars, which is great, and, you know, safety features, brilliant, but the human is still needed to drive the car. And I don't think that's ever going to change for a very long period of time. And I think it's the same thing with AI. I think when AI matures, it will help humans to make better decisions, to become more productive, but we're always going to need the humans in the driving seat of all the various kind of jobs and everything else down the line. So I don't think it's going to have a significant impact on the labour market as other people are predicting.
And I think that's fascinating because it's so overhyped right now. And to hear that from an expert whose whole career and industry is based on data is so important, because there's too many people out there. I was at a conference last week. I never knew Ireland had so many AI experts. It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's the biggest growth industry is becoming an AI expert and bashing it on your LinkedIn. So I think that's really interesting to get that. What's one thing in your personal life you spend money on that makes you happy?
Gadgets. I love gadgets, whether it's the latest smartwatch, the smartphone.
Give me specifics. I'm a big gadget man.
I'm on the Android, so I'm the Google Pixel. So I have the Pixel Buds, the Pixel Watch, the Pixel Phone, and they're all in coordinate. So that's good. The Remarkable. Love my
Is
Remarkable.
Is that good?
It's good.
Obviously can see I'm analog. I love my Moleskine. Nothing gives me more pleasure than a new Moleskine.
I'm the same. I love just writing. But what I find is brilliant around this is that I could have wrote something in a meeting 6 months ago, and if I had my notepad out, it's so hard to find that notes you're looking for. With the Remarkable, you can flick back to it. You can take your notes. You can share them. It just digitalizes my notepad.
I've seen more and more people using them.
Yeah, no, I think it is definitely maturing. Smart home, then smart blinds. Yeah, various bits and pieces like that. I'm a big man for convenience. It's like incremental little improvements.
Yeah.
And if gadgets and tech can do that, and also the data that's coming off it, I love the data around.
We have Alexas everywhere in the house. Yeah. It's just simple things. Like, I ask it 50 questions a day. Now it's all boring. Like, hey, Alex, what time is it?
What's the weather going to be like today before you get dressed?
But it's tiny, tiny things. Like, we all pay, you know, that joke about, like, we wanted flying cars. We got 140 characters. But, like, it is micro adjustments that make your life a little bit better, a little bit frictionless. And then finally, what's your final piece of advice to every entrepreneur listening?
I think there's two things. One is very practical and one is more aspirational, I suppose. The practical piece is, if you're starting out and you're like, look, I want to go start a business, try and find founder market fit. So a lot of people talk about product market fit and building a product and fitting a market. Where we actually, and I think it was probably the biggest reason for myself and Alan's success, is it was the founder market fit. There's a couple of reasons. Alan's obvious one is the bus industry. He came from the bus industry. So when we were telling the story to investors or potential VCs, you know, we had the credibility. When we were off meeting Bob and the industry executives, we had credibility. When we were meeting the users, we had credibility because we were one of them. We were part of the industry. We knew a lot about it. We knew what to build. Massive. Then that mixed in with my tech skills and the tech background to complement Alan's industry, and the fact that we were friends. We knew each other for such a long period of time. We can argue, we can fight, we can do whatever. We've been best friends since we were 12. You know, I think I said someone, we're best friends for 12 years and we've been co-founders for about 8 years. So I think that founder market fit is really important. So if you're starting out, what skills do you have or a co-founder you can find may have to put it, you know, to make that kind of founder market fit, get the timing right. The other one, and it was somebody who was on your podcast recently, Paul Hayes, said to us.
Oh God, don't give him another shout out. He'll be delighted.
I remember he was down in Galway. We were having dinner with him during the early stages, and we were very, and we probably still are, but we wouldn't celebrate our wins. We'd get a fund around close. It was next thing. We need to sign a client. We need to do the next thing. We need to do the next thing. And he kind of, you know, had a word with us, and he was like, lads, you need to enjoy the journey and celebrate the wins. Because he was like, I've seen all the people come before, and they all say, I'll celebrate at the end. I'll celebrate at the end. And then it's too late. There's nobody to celebrate with. It's, you know, you're too focused. And his big piece to us was, you know, celebrate the journey, enjoy the journey as you're going. I listen to him sometimes and bits of it, but I really believe it's critically important. Like the friendship you build along the way, to, you know, be there with, share the journey with family and friends and just enjoy every piece of it as you're going. Because I think it's critically important. I think a lot of people, we're all probably a little bit guilty of it, trying to wait till the end to celebrate. And then either it's too late or whatever happens in between. So yeah, to enjoy the journey.
It's probably the biggest learning I've had in the last 18 months in the pod. Obviously, you have different learnings at different times of your life as you go through this. Not to throw more flowers on Paul Hayes that he doesn't need, but like, he's 100% right, because I've chatted to hundreds of founders now, and I always ask the question, you know, how to feel when you sold? How to feel when, you know, this happened and that happened and you had the big exit and the end, right? How do you feel when you got to the end? And 9 times out of 10, nothing. We felt nothing. And it's the saddest thing in the world. My little tiny heart breaks every time I sit across from someone and go, didn't feel anything. I want you to do Monday. Just went and started another business.
And it's, there is no end. That's the infinite moral game. Of the story.
The game, it play the infinite game. We chatted over coffee about it. Just survive to thrive. Get there, enjoy it, have fun, stay in the market long enough, because you never know what's coming around the corner, good and bad. And it's completely right. And it's cliched as hell. Enjoy the journey, but it's 100% true, because life is seasons, right? You'll have summers and winters, and when you're in the summer, you got to enjoy it. You never know what that summer will bring.
That's it, winter is coming.
Not to end on a completely pessimistic note, but it's true.
It is
the journey, and you know, we talked about earlier, like, we sometimes you don't realize how good you have it right in that moment. I mean, look at you right now, okay? You've got the funding secured, you've found product market fit, you're expanding rapidly. Life is good.
But, and like, looking back on it, it's like, I'm getting to live my dream. If I went back as a teenager, this was the dream. The dream was to go and build a VC-backed, globally scalable business. I'm doing it with my best friend from school, and I've made a load of new best friends along the way.
If you looked at your story on paper, just a different name on top. I had this conversation with my wife the other day. If you just scribble out your name and put someone else, put Brian's and put Ben's name there, you'd be like, damn, that's class. I think sometimes you need to step back out of context. Brian, that was an absolute pleasure. Where could people learn more about you and City Swift?
All the usual places, look, cityswift.com, and we're all on the Instagram, LinkedIn, and the social media channel, City Swift.
Sweet. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gary.